Hi, everyone. My name is Monica Matha. I work in a private family office in New York, and I've spent the past 15 years investing in and advising small businesses. I'm a columnist for Bloomberg Businessweek and Inc. magazine, and a talking head on television. And I just wrote my first book called The Entrepreneurial Instinct, which just came out. And if you're here today, it's because we're going to talk about risk-taking and getting better at it. So I would love to learn a little bit more about you and then tell you what I've learned about risk-taking. So if you are interested in starting a business, I'd love to see by just a quick raise of hands, who's interested in starting a business here? Okay. If you own a business and are still interested in risk-taking, I'd love to see a raise of hands. Okay, so a lot of business owners in this crowd. And if you are just looking to embrace risk a little bit more, be a little bit more enterprising in your life, and that's why you're here, raise your hands. Okay, some of those too. So I want to tell you a little bit about me, and I think that will give you a little color as to why I'm even up here talking about taking risks. I'm the daughter of self-made immigrants, and I don't think my story is very unlike a lot of other people I know. My dad was a merchant marine ship's captain, and my mom was an artist, and we lived on a boat. Maybe that's a little different. So we lived on a boat when I was younger, and we used to sail around, and when my brother and I were coming of age to attend school, my dad had to completely change his career. We just couldn't do that life anymore. And so he took half of his life savings and invested it in Indian handicrafts and just decided that he was going to start a business. And his sister lived in the U.S. We didn't really know anyone else here. And my aunt was like, well, it's the land of opportunity. Come on over. And so we moved here in 1980. And my dad had all these handicrafts. And without any kind of plan, he just kind of went door to door, knocking on all of these retailers' doors to see if anyone would take his wares, and nobody would. He spent a month doing that, and my mom was like, we need to talk a little bit about this business. So, he was determined to do it, so he kept knocking on doors, and another month passed, and finally he decided that he needed to take a job. They needed to have money coming in, and so he took a job as a ship surveyor, and he was making half of what he made as a ship's captain. And when no one would take his stuff, he decided, you know what, I need to open my own retail store. So then he started going to all of these landlords, asking them if he could get a lease. And he had some money in the bank. Living on the ship for 16 years, he'd saved some money up. But no one would give him a lease. With no credit history at all, he basically couldn't get anyone to take a risk on him. And so, he ended up working. He was working that job. He never lost sight of the fact that he wanted to start a business. And in his off hours, he would go and look for leases. And finally, about 9 months after we moved here, he found someone willing to give him a lease. And it was a restaurant space, which he converted with his own hands. And finally, he opened this retail store, and over 30 years, they built a retail store that turned into an apparel chain that then turned into a garment wholesaling company that made clothes for the retail stores, which then led rise to them investing in real estate here and there. And that started a diversified investment company that owns shopping centers, office towers, housing developments. And this all came from people who had absolutely no business experience and no training to really believe that they could do it. And as a kid, I would watch them, and I would just scratch my head. Nothing they ever did made any kind of sense. I think that's a common theme among children and parents. But So I grew up here, and it was a completely different idea as to how people find success. You're supposed to get straight A's, and you're supposed to go to the Ivy League school, and then you're supposed to get that experience. And that's what I did. I was a good student, so that worked out for me. And, I thought, hey, I'm going to one-up my parents. Look at how much they did, and they had no training. And so I went to the Ivy League school. I got the venture capital jobs, and I only ever wanted to be like them. And I found at the end of the day, I couldn't do what they could do with all this training, and they had no training at all. And it frustrated me. So that's what made me really want to understand, what is it that allows some people to take a blank canvas and make something? And so that led me down this journey to try to understand, you know, what is it that allows some people to be so darn entrepreneurial? And I just started doing what comes naturally to me, which is talking. So I picked up the phone and I started having conversations with people, entrepreneurs who had found success with no business plans altogether. And just out of sheer coincidence, I was introduced to doctors of neuroscience that study financial risk-taking in the stock market. And all of a sudden, the stars started to align. And as I started digging into this neuroscience research and behavioral psychology research, I found that there's actually a very succinct connection to your ability to take risks and physiology. And so it was something that, as a person who, you know, I've loved entrepreneurship my whole life, and I'd never run across anything like this. And as I started scratching further and further into this, I found that this was actually information that I felt really needed to be out there. Like, we need to understand the connection between just our innate talents, our wiring, and our instinct, and our ability to take risks. And so that's why I'm here today, and that's why I'm talking to you, because, you know, your likelihood of becoming the next Steve Jobs has a whole lot more to do with your ability to make a risky choice than your intelligence, your IQ, where you went to school. It's a subject that we don't cover in school, and it's a very important subject for anyone who's seeking to make more with less. And given our current economic times, that's the name of the game. Got to make more with less. And so I'd love to share a little bit with you about what I learned from all of these conversations with entrepreneurs and talking to these neuroscience guys. I promise I won't bore you. And, you know, I'd love to talk to you and hear about how you want to take risks in your life and how I can help you be better at it. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about some research that I ran across. It's out of Cambridge University, and it was out of 2008. Researchers basically took entrepreneurs and corporate managers who have equivalent IQ and experience, and they gave them a battery of tests. They put little wires to their brains, and they gave them behavioral psychology tests. And they found that when you give these two groups information and say, hey, will you make some decisions based on this information, they respond pretty much the same. But when you give these groups the choice of making risky bets, upside and downside gain, hey, you have something to win, you have something to lose, there was a big, big difference. The entrepreneurs as a group overwhelmingly made riskier bets. And they found in their fMRI scans that there was actually chemical activity in their brain. There was something going on in a side of the brain that actually made them impulsive. And the other thing they found is that it's not just this impulsivity, but there is a, when you look at their scores and of behavioral tests, they actually are more adaptable. So if you're looking at entrepreneurs and trying to understand, well, what in the world makes them different? They're impulsive and they're adaptable. And what the researchers learned is when you combine the two, it turns into a formula to be a reward-oriented risk taker, or someone who knows how to take risks for gains. And for the rest of us out there who are trying to be better risk takers ourselves, understand that some people are just wired to do this naturally. It just comes easily to some, just like it comes easily to John Legend to sing really well. Some people just know how to take risks. But entrepreneurs are really born and made. And so by understanding how some of these people do it naturally and dissecting the little components, the rest of us can learn how to do it as well. And so you know, what I'd like to share with you is what I've learned about our human physiology and our ability to take risks. So what they found is that impulsivity is stored in the brain, and it's what translates into business as a bias to action. It's the ability to just move forward, not sitting there planning and planning and planning, but actually take action. And being impulsive can be pretty dangerous in all sorts of aspects of life. I mean, you can become a drug addict, you can drive your car off a cliff, I don't know what. But when you counterbalance that impulsivity with the ability to be adaptable, or just the ability to roll with the punches, it turns into a magic formula for risk taking. And the other big discovery when it comes to just the way we're wired is understanding that how we as people respond to risky situations or ambiguous situations plays a big role in our ability to take smart risks. It's human nature to run from the ambiguous, to run from things that we don't understand. The side of the brain that feels fear is the loss aversion side. And it is the knee-jerk reaction for 85% of people in the population to basically run for cover when you're dealing with a situation that you just don't know how to handle. And what we're taught is that when you're facing these situations, the first thing you should do is plan. The first thing you should do is, you know, ask those 20 questions, and through the planning and through the analyzing and the processing, that somehow you're going to be able to work through the situation. That sort of thought process is actually at odds with the way we're wired. What researchers have discovered is that by planning when you're facing uncertainty, you're actually more deeply rooting yourself in this loss aversion behavior. And the people who know how to take risks know how to trigger another side of the brain, which is the reward pathway, or which is the side of the brain that makes us feel pleasure, makes us feel concentration and learning. And the key for people who want to become better at risk taking is understanding that in order to take a risk, you have to learn how to shut down the fear in order to activate the reward. And so by just understanding this basic 101 of how we're wired, you can get a little closer to taking risks yourself. And I hope I'm not boring you with all of this scientific fact-telling and information, but I'd like to just distill it down to you in terms of a couple things you can do in your own life, in your everyday life, to just become a better risk taker. And so one is just to say yes a little bit more in life. When you're faced with a situation where you're not sure if you should do it, you're not sure what the point is, rather than sitting there and asking the 20 questions and analyzing, practice saying yes. Because what saying yes does is it basically activates the same side of the brain that triggers the reward pathway. It makes you focused on putting yourself out there. And if you say yes and then adopt a "I'll make the best of it" approach, you're going to find automatically that you're slowly going to become a better risk taker. Another thing you can do is have faith, and I think this is something that you hear from a lot of people. But if you think about the whole idea of faith, what's really deeply rooted in that idea is an optimism that it's worth doing this because it's going to turn out. It's going to be okay. And so by taking these little leaps of faith, again, you're triggering the side of the brain that actually activates the reward pathway. I mean, so simple, and maybe something that you hear in church, but it actually does things to make you a better risk taker. Another thing you can do is to start small, because the research actually shows that you can condition yourself to be a better risk taker. So by taking very, very small leaps in your life, starting a little hobby business, inadvertently you're actually training yourself to get more comfortable with these risky processes. And over time, and you won't even notice it's happening, you're going to be able to take on bigger risks and be able to take leaps with bigger situations. So start small and, you know, just give yourself the chance to feel comfortable with this ambiguity. And finally, and I think women struggle with this, practice quick decision making. Stop trying on 20 outfits. Pick the first thing that you see and pick something different every day. And while, again, this doesn't seem like anything big, it actually, again, just touches and lights up the same side of the brain that makes you a little bit more impulsive, that gets you more comfortable with taking risks. And, you know, it's something you can even do in a restaurant. Go to a restaurant, open the menu, pick the first thing, and smile your way through that shrimp casserole dish. It'll be fine. And over time, you're going to find you're actually becoming a better risk taker. So I hope some of these little things can help you understand that, you know, while there's a neuroscience behind it, while there's a behavioral psychology behind it, it's an everyday, there are everyday opportunities to make yourself more comfortable with risks and to stop yourself from getting in your own way when it comes to taking risks. And since this is an expert exchange, I want to hear from you. I want to hear about what kinds of things you're struggling with, what you'd like to be better at in terms of risk taking, and I'll do my best to help you. Come on up.
I actually just want to share with everyone, if you know NBC's Lou Anne Kahn, it was life-changing for her. She did 365 days of firsts where she challenged herself every day with something new. Like her first day was doing the polar bear plunge or eating dessert all day. But after a year, she was like a changed person. She wasn't just status quo anymore. So just try something new every day and learn something. Take a chance, you know, challenge yourself. So you're right on target. Great message. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Stephanie McCullough. I'm a financial advisor, and I work a lot with women. And we talk a lot about the behavioral finance and the neuroeconomics, that kind of how our brains aren't wired to help us in the money side. But a big part of my message is also that risk is everywhere. So people think they can avoid risk by putting their money in a, you know, CD at the bank, but you're not earning any money. So any of those tips on, you know, how to accept the fact that even maybe not doing something that feels risky has a risky side to it. Do you think that helps part of the neurological piece of it?
Yeah, actually the study of this neurofinance, neuroeconomics as it relates to the stock market is far more covered than even the entrepreneurship angle. I think I've seen even less on entrepreneurship. But the basic idea is that most of us are wired to just run from loss. The minute that you see something where you just, you know, don't have all the facts in front of you, the knee-jerk reaction is to feel loss. And the psychologists that discovered that fear is 2.5 times more powerful than reward or greed actually won the Nobel Prize in economics. I mean, this is something that's very real and that we all face. And in the stock market, it's what makes you sit with a dog in your portfolio, watching your portfolio go down, 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 and not take action. Because, you know, the minute that you understand that you've lost something, you're just in demotivation mode. So I think the biggest thing you can do is just understand that loss aversion exists, and it's a very natural tendency, and it's something that we all face. And especially for entrepreneurs, when you sign up to become an entrepreneur, you're basically signing up to spend, you know, the next several years of your life facing ambiguity every day. You're signing up to have to deal with setbacks and failure on a regular basis. So you need to learn how to deal with setbacks and failures, and it's really something that a business plan doesn't teach you how to do. Most of the planning techniques that we focus on help us avoid risks, but it doesn't tell you what to do when you actually have to take risks and then pick yourself up when things don't work out. It's a very important skill set.
Hi, I'm Debbie Wagner from The Graphic Edge. I think one of the biggest risks, I've had my business, it'll be 31 years now, but I think one of the biggest risks was starting the business, but then realizing, I had my father encouraging me, was, do I hire an employee? That was like one of my biggest things, so I did. I hired my first employee, first it was part-time, then it was full-time, then I hired a second, and then I hired a third. But that was the biggest, biggest risk. And ongoing, okay, keeping the work up. But once I got over that first hurdle, it was easy. So that was it.
And I think that's very natural. I think, you know, it's so many entrepreneurs really hesitate when it comes to taking the office space, when it comes to hiring that first person, when it comes to actually spending the money. And, you know, that's actually one area where I would advocate that you do a lot of planning. When it comes to spending money, the people who start businesses based on instinct, the successful ones seem to understand that since you don't really know where the road's taking you and that there's going to be twists, turns, and potholes all over the place, that the only way you're going to survive the journey is by really having your resources close to your vest and being very careful with spending money. And so, you know, by looking at people like my parents and through all the discoveries of all of this risk-taking, it's spending money is one area where I think it really makes a lot of sense to think a lot before you part with your cash.
Hello, I'm Heather Lamb. Whoa, that's like a lot louder in my head to you. I'm Heather Lamb. I'm the co-founder of a group known as the Grown-Ass Woman Brigade. I have the impulsive down pretty well, actually. We were galloping through the halls last night. Yes, Carol, I'm telling on you. We actually get up and, I mean, I encourage the women in our group to do those kinds of things. Get up and do it. Just, you want to gallop through a room? Who cares? These people are never going to see you again. Go do it. Enjoy yourself. Just have a good time. In my own life, I've done that by making snap decisions. Like, I lost 70 pounds this last year. Some people had heard me say that. I lost 70 pounds this last year. After 14 years of agonizing over telling somebody I was in love with him, I finally told him I was in love with him, and I just moved out to be with him in California. When I decided that I was going to do that, I impulsively took a job that I can work from home. So now all of a sudden, I'm working from wherever I want. My problem, I think, is not so much taking the risk because, and I should say this too, as people go, oh my God, I'd be totally terrified to do any of that stuff. I actually suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. So I have to, that making these decisions is really, as impulsive as they sound, it is actually a conscious sort of, it first goes through my head, and that'd be funny to do that. But then afterwards, I'm like, oh no, maybe I shouldn't. And I'm going to go with the first response. I'm going to go ahead and do it. But the impulsivity that I have, the problem I tend to have is actually focusing enough to stay with it through the entrepreneurship portion of it. Now, when we formed GOB, we did it just to help our friends introduce our really amazing women friends because we felt that there was not enough opportunity for those women friends to meet. And it sort of took a life of its own, and they want me to speak, and people are seeing me as a product. I had never really thought of myself as a product. So now I'm facing kind of the opposite problem where I have no problem getting up and speaking in front of people. I have no problems doing any of these things. I'm just not really sure how to do the reverse part of it where you kind of reverse engineer it into a, oh, well, now I'm going to make it into a business. Do you have any advice for people who might be backward?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not up here saying that planning is a bad thing. And I think that you have some quality problems, losing all this weight, meeting the man you love, and moving out there and taking jobs. I think you're hitting a stage now where in business you would say that you found your proof of concept. Like you have something that people want, and now it's at a point where actually you should start the planning. And this is the phase that I think most people would tell you. It's you have something that works, and now it's time for you to figure out how to dedicate your resources to scale that product that you have. So this is the time where I think the MBA machinery and all of the typical business planning could actually help you a lot. If impulsivity is good for you, now it's time to like sit down, concentrate, and make the plans and stick to them. But you've got some quality problems. So. Any other questions? Yes.
Can you talk about some of the entrepreneurs that you interviewed and share some of the stories that you found most inspiring?
Sure. It was really interesting to speak to the entrepreneurs because they just ran the gamut. One of the people I got to speak with was Lisa Price, who started Carol's Daughter. And she was really interesting because it's a beauty brand. And she was really interesting because she actually is not the kind of person who would be wired to do this from the start. She struggled with quite a bit of lack of confidence and weight problems and just, you know, not really believing in herself. And that turned into a level of pessimism that for a good portion of her life, she struggled to move things forward because she kept, you know, kind of getting in her own way. And for her, she found success through a series of small successes. She had been dabbling in making these perfumed creams and soaps and shampoos. And finally, her mom was like, you know, why don't you go to the flea market and sell that stuff? I think you could make some money doing it. And you know, while Carol had so much pessimism, the idea of going to a flea market was like, hey, yeah, you know, my aunt's going to be there. She's going to be selling apple pie. My uncle's going to be there too. So it's just actually spending time with the family. And she didn't even realize it, but she was starting a business. You know, so she made her soaps and she made her shampoos and she went there over the weekend and found that everything sold out. And on her way out, someone handed her a flyer for another flea market the next weekend. And this woman has built a very successful beauty company and she had no plan, and it was those tiny little successes that brought her there. And you know, the people who study neuroscience will tell you that there's actually something to the tiny successes. Every time your brain actually experience as a success, you experience that little chemical release that we were talking about earlier that those entrepreneurs experience. And when you're having that chemical release, you're able to focus more, you're able to learn more, you're actually having fun, and it all makes you want to re-experience that emotion. So by taking very small steps towards a bigger goal that you want, you can physiologically push yourself in the right direction in terms of starting a business. So her story was really interesting because it's someone who you'd look at and be like, wow, you know, she's not wired to be an entrepreneur, but her situation kind of put her in that circumstance. And there were other interesting people as well. I spoke to the founder of Clif Bar, and you know, he didn't even start his business until he was 35. And he was a guy that loved extreme sports, and gosh, you'd look at him and be like, you're just a risk taker. I mean, he would climb ice rocks, and I mean, so dangerous. And you know, what he had to tell me was that a lot of those things that he did actually conditioned him to be a better risk taker too. He talked a little bit about being younger and playing jazz improv in high school, and how he would actually go out of his way not to plan the solo that he would do. And he would just go out there and see what happened. And just the fact that he did it and survived and did it again conditioned him to understand that, you know what, these little things aren't a big deal. When you go out there and you skip the planning and you survive it and you can be adaptable and creative, it's conditioning you to take bigger risks in life. So it was a great experience. Any other questions? Yeah.
Circuitous all over the place, ended up where it was supposed to be, but I found it rather frustrating to watch this process go through. So to your point of planning or not planning, but that entrepreneur that, you know, get rid of the fear, just go for the reward and have confidence in yourself that you know it's going to come out to the right place is really foreign to someone who's always been somewhat linear. And I would say to anyone that has a friend or is interested in entrepreneurship just to be patient, because you do end up where you're supposed to be. It just is, it can be a really, it can be quite a roller coaster.
So there's some really interesting studies that actually look at people who thrive in ambiguous situations and know how to just create things. There was a study on jazz musicians and looking at these people who, in the process of doing scat or improv playing, they again wired these guys up in the brain, and they found that like when they're in the moment of creating something from nothing, doing these scats, they're actually shutting off the side of the brain that plans. And that may be, it's the prefrontal cortex, and it may be why some of the people who plan have a harder time getting their head around this like ambiguous creative process. It's a completely different side of the brain, and a lot of the skills you learn in the planning process don't relate to creativity and don't really relate to being adaptable in an evolving atmosphere. So I thought that was an interesting data point. I would love to hear from someone who's thinking about starting a business and, you know, some of the things that you're doing to help yourself get out there. Is there anyone willing to share their story and the idea they have and what they'd love to do? Yes, right there.
Well, it's not that I'm thinking of starting something. I started a business about a month ago. So I opened up a wellness center in Center City. And my biggest fear is, how do I step back and hire somebody, which you were talking about. But I know we're about to get busy. I have all these flyers out. It's going to happen. But I feel like I'm going to get my butt kicked. And then someone's going to say, well, you're just more prepared. But I have all these resumes. Every day I look at them, and I'm like, but what if they're not as good as me? What do I do? Then I have a bad name. So it's like, how do I get beyond that?
So are you, is the concern a financial decision, or just that trusting someone else to take care of your business the same way you take care of your business?
Essentially, that's it. Because I do massage, and I'm an injury specialist, so I have a lot of very specific people that come to me that want what I do. But every time I work with those people, I can't imagine, you know, and then I work with other people, and it's not that they're not as good as me, I can always help them, but I also wonder if I bring them in, are we going to be busy enough to pay them? What if they're not busy? What if I can't take care of them? What if they need to make more money? Am I just going to be going through therapists? I mean, those are the things that I'm going through. I mean, I already have an acupuncturist on the side. Those things don't bother me. But now I'm back where I was 2 months ago when I decided I'm just going to be on my own. I'm not going to work for anyone else. And I was like, oh, that's a risk. And then I went to myself making my own paycheck, and I was like, oh, I can do this. I can make my own paycheck. And then my partner and I, we built this spa, built every wall, and now I'm back to where I am, like, just me running it. But I need to hire someone.
Right, so I think that the issue that you're facing is going from self-employment to actually employing others and scaling your business. And I think this is something you're going to have to get comfortable with.
How do you scale that? Because I know how to get to where I am now, but I have a lot of people. My phone's constantly ringing. I'm getting busier.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
And I'm so picky.
Sussing out the quality of the people that work for you is kind of what you're talking about. And it would require oversight. You know, you can't just hand over your business to some random person that you bring off the street without sussing them out and seeing, you know, whether they can offer the quality of care that you're offering your clients. So it would be, I think, a trial and error process. Like, you need to bring someone in. You need to cut your downside risk as much as possible. So if you can bring that person in on a trial basis and, you know, offer them X number of hours, then you can see the extent to which you can actually use them. Like, are their hours being covered? I would hope that in the kind of business that you're in, you would have a little bit of flexibility with that. And I think, you know, it's a tough job market, so you shouldn't feel shy about negotiating with the people that you're bringing in. And, you know, it's an opportunity for them, and you can, with whatever terms you set up with this person, structure it such that you're letting them do work, and you're seeing how well they perform. You can survey the people that they work with, and you can see, based on that feedback, is it worthwhile having this person? But I think that's a bandage you're going to have to rip off unless you want to be a sole proprietor offering services on your own. If you want to scale, you're going to have to learn how to bring other people in, and the best way to do that is to make it as flexible of an arrangement as possible. Okay. I hope that helps.
That does help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, right there.
Ways to hire people without making the commitment to full employment for that person.
Right. It sounds like the same principles in terms of having some sort of flexibility in that arrangement so you can have a trial of some kind.
Particularly when you're hiring somebody who's a professional, and a massage therapist is a professional. Those are people that lend themselves to being independent contractors.
Okay. And we have a lot of business owners in this audience. I'd love to hear about some of the kinds of issues that you're having a hard time getting your head around in terms of when to move forward, when to pull back. I think one of the things that we see is that women are starting more businesses than any other group in the U.S., but a lot of those businesses aren't really getting very big. The percentage of businesses that crack the $1 million mark is very, very small. So is anyone having a hard time thinking about what's the right time to get a loan? Does anyone here struggle with that? Yes, back there.
Hi, my name's Colleen Mook, and can you guys hear me?
No.
My name's Colleen Mook, and the name of my business is Baby Be Hip. And I've had it for 10 years, and it's sort of, I have four children, so it's sort of just like a hobby jobby. And this is the first year that I'm really focusing on growing my business. Sort of got into the Make Mine a Million Dollar Business program, where we're trying to reach $1 million in annual revenues. So I'm starting to work on my business. We're up 80%, which is awesome, but I've grown my business on cash flow to this point. So now, in order to go big, you need money to make money. So, like, I just started with a line of credit. So then it's like, okay, what's next? Because I know I need to get into sourcing. So I'm running into different kinds of problems. They're all strategic. Like, I love what I'm learning, but, you know, like, what's the next step? Is it a gut? I'm trying to talk to all these people that are bigger and better and that have done it. And I know you need some planning, and I'm not a planner.
The planning is very important, especially when you're talking about taking other people's cash to grow your business. You're mostly going to be looking at a variety of debt resources or being creative in terms of working with your service providers to give you better terms. That's the way a lot of people are getting loans today is through the relationships. They're getting loans from the people that they work with. So whoever's providing you goods or services, getting better terms with them so that you can defer paying them for 30 days or 60 days, and that gives you cash flow to grow your business. If you're looking for actual cash to, like, open a retail storefront or, you know, to expand
goods.
Source goods. So do you have orders that are in your hand, or how does it work for you?
No, that's like the big vision of the company. So now I'm doing little one-off orders, $50, $60, no problem. We do that all day long. But I want to, you know, make it a big brand and get into the... So I'm thinking big, but so I'm trying to solve some of my little problems and running into some issues. So,
well, if you're cash flow positive and you're making at least 20% from your operating business, then you would be a candidate for a loan. You could go to a bank and they would look at you. If you've been around for at least 3 years and can show that you're profitable, then you are actually a candidate for a conventional loan.
And that's better than using our own resources.
It depends what you want to do with the money. So if you really need to have a reason for taking the cash to go to a bank, because at the end of the day, you're going to be paying interest on that money. The money's not coming for free, so you better have some real plans that you can use to put that money to work. I think you need to go back and strategize a little bit and think about exactly what you want to do with your business. And depending, if you are cash flow positive, which is what it sounds like, then you would be candidate for a loan.
Okay.
If you've been around a little while and you're cash flow positive, you could do it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Is anyone else wondering how they can take steps to grow their business? I know we have a lot of business owners here. Yes.
I do a lot of counseling people on business planning. You mentioned the pull and the tension between planning and taking risks. And I tell people to plan but don't overplan. Can you talk about that? And I have to say I'm one of the worst about overplanning everything. So can you talk about that tension and how to find the right amount of planning?
Sure. Business planning is actually really important for a business, and it serves a lot of purpose. I think where I don't necessarily think we're using that planning properly is the stage at which your business is in before you really spend all the time with the planning. And I've talked to a number of business school professors about this as well. And I think the difficulty here is that business is an evolution. Most people that start a business don't really know where that business is going to go when they start. They may have some ideas, but you know what? That beautiful 60-page business plan that you write kind of gets thrown out the window within the first month or two of actually starting a business when you start to see which of the assumptions you're making are completely off base. And so I think business planning comes in handy when you actually have proof of concept, when you know that what you have is something that people want and they're willing to pay money for, then you know you have something. Then you have something in front of you that you can sit down and think about, well, how can I actually sell more of this? How can I sell this to a point that I can make a profit? How can I eke out even more from that and really make this like a wealth-creating situation for me? But spending all that time writing the business plan when you don't even have your first customer doesn't really do a whole lot for you because you're operating in a bubble. And I think that's why you see one of two Americans at some point in their life has wanted to start a business, but only 0.5% actually do it. So it's that loss aversion process that comes with the planning that actually talks a lot of people out of doing anything altogether. I hope that answers your question. right there.
So it's not quite a business yet, but so I just started blogging in the sense that I'm working on a novel, and you know, there's the two routes to go where it's you get it published professionally or you go self-publishing. And if you go professionally, the turnaround time for me is just, it's too long. So I wanted to start the blog, get a readership, eventually turn it into being able to sell my novel off of that blog. So it's been up and running about 2 months now, and it's kind of one of those things where I had enough of a plan that like it's in motion, and every day like I just started very small where every day I invite, so it's called Take It or Leave It, The Random Musings of a Warrior Princess, and I call it my Warrior Princess Strong Arm. Meaning I invite, like I take one person and sign them up a day. So I'm kind of growing very small because it's not that big yet. But strategically looking into the future and having a business mind with this, do you have any things that are coming to your mind right now? I don't really have a specific question, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's one thing I want to understand. So you're blogging, and is this for a passion, or do you want to, like, where do you see this going? Do you have any kind of vision for where you want to see all of this going someday, even if it's a little pie in the sky?
Well, I'm trying to establish myself as a writer. So it's right now, it's just a writing practice that I do every day. It's never longer than 600 words, and it's really it's 9 to 5, and it's for the entertainment of, you know, I call it the gray box, people that work in cubicles Monday through Friday. So it's kind of just to start getting and having that self-discipline. As far as a vision, it's twofold. One is to sell the novel eventually, which is going to happen before my 30th birthday, and I'm 27. And two is to kind of create a common ground, because I think there's a lot of artists that need just a jump-off spot, like so kind of like an artist at play type thing.
Okay, so putting my business hat on.
Yes.
The way you make money with something like that is content sites are driven very much by eyeballs. So how many people are coming to your site, reading that content every day, and what can marketers put on your site to get to those eyeballs? So if you're looking for just a way to create income while you're gaining this experience as a writer by blogging, then it's all about traffic. It's all about getting people to your site. The other thing that I see authors and content providers do is they find ways to sell the people who are coming to their site other related content. So, you know, can you do like Kindle single type things? Can you offer, you know, one-off 99 cent, $1.99 type product offerings? Is there merchandising? Like once you get enough people coming into your community that you're building, can you offer them something else of value from this product? So for someone, before you actually even have a book to sell, it's all about bringing a readership to your content. And by bringing that readership, you're going to get a following. And that following is going to help you get a book deal. That following and that readership is also helping you get marketing revenue from everybody, that the clicks that are coming to your site. And you know, finally, it's if you can find a focused enough niche with what you're writing about, can you offer that reader little, small, you know, low ticket value items, like the Kindle single, like the one chapter, the one small story. Those would be the initial ideas that I have for you. And, you know, self-publishing has really gotten to the point where, you know, it's not like book deals are so great for first-time authors. I can tell you this with experience. So, you know, it depends, like, why you're trying to write the book. If it fits into part of a platform that you're building, or if it's a prestige thing for you. These days, writing a book is not about making the money anymore. So even published authors really have to think about how do they monetize their content and how do they translate that following into something more tangible with money. I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Good afternoon. This has been great so far, so thank you for that. I have had a good, solid career in corporate America, and I've decided to make a shift. And I have an opportunity ahead of me to join a couple partners who have a small business in existence, and they know it needs to be revitalized, and they'd like me to come in as a third partner and be part of that plan. So in many ways, this lines up with a passion area and a place where I know I can have a positive impact. And I will find that very rewarding for what I want to do next in my career. That is very clear. What's unclear for me is the ability for this organization to make money short, mid, long term that would satisfy me and that I would find that piece rewarding. So I'm sitting here listening, and I wouldn't say I'm fearful at all about moving in this direction and my own abilities and my abilities to contribute and make this better. I guess if I have fear, it's about the ability to earn some good money in doing so. So what feedback do you have for me? Maybe what milestones can I set along the way to tell me if this is, you know, a go, no-go place for me?
Yeah, I think you're thinking about things the right way, because where I think you really need to plan is when it comes to finances. And again, the decision you're making is very much so a financial decision. If you want to take the leap, at some point this does need to compensate you to the degree that you were compensated in corporate America. Frankly, it needs to compensate you more because you're taking a risk. And, you know, with that comes downside. So with these partners you're talking to, have they offered any kind of business plan? Have they prepared projections? And, you know, can you look at those projections and really think about, are they making reasonable assumptions? Do you really feel that this business can hit the trajectory that they're talking about? Can you slice almost 50% off of what they think they're going to do? And can you still find the financial success that you're looking for? Like, these are very valid questions. And I think the other side of it that you also can't ignore is your own personal financial runway. So when you sign up to be an entrepreneur, you're setting yourself up for a pretty ambiguous path yourself. And you need to make sure that your own financial wherewithal can withstand that. And so I recommend to a lot of entrepreneurs that you need to have at least a 6-month emergency fund just for yourself. And you need to do whatever you can 6 to 8 months before you actually even think about being an entrepreneur to get your financial house in order. You need to think about your credit score, because your credit score is actually going to go down once you become an entrepreneur. You don't have the same kind of ability to get loans in the future, because when you go to try to get a mortgage, you know, you don't have a regular income anymore. And these are things that you should think about before you start a business. Right now would be the time to think about, can you bring in any kind of consulting revenue? Can you do a little bit of work on the side so that, again, you can withstand the journey a little bit longer? Because, you know, the only thing you can count on with this is a big fat question mark. Mm-hmm. And so you have to decide, is there financial upside in this? Are the people that you're potentially going to work with the kind of people that can deliver? Are they people that you can get along with? And can you withstand the road? I think you're thinking about it the right way.
Okay, great feedback. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. So I provide services to the nonprofit sector. And by definition, they don't have a lot of money. So sometimes I hit big potholes. And part of my marketing plan is running a networking program for nonprofit professionals. There's not a lot of professional development support within nonprofit agencies. It's desperately needed. And I'm struggling with the business model for that networking program, because I can't just use it as a marketing tool, because there's so much need for it. And part of the risk that I see that's out there is that I need to actually go after sponsorship dollars.
Okay.
And I'm trying to put myself out there in a way that makes it attractive to funders, especially funders that subscribe to the theory that a networked nonprofit community is a more effective nonprofit community. Any advice on how I sort of get over that hurdle?
So I have a couple questions for you first. Are you setting this up to be a for-profit business yourself?
Yes.
Okay, and so that your target is to provide services to nonprofit employees with the idea of helping them network among themselves, maybe finding some efficiencies, helping each other. So you need to find kind of the pressure points with the people that you're working with. I'm going to take a big leap here, but I would think that most people in the nonprofit community are struggling with fundraising these days.
Correct.
So I would think that whatever you need to do right now needs to come with the end game of by meeting each other, you're going to be in a better position to raise dollars. And so when you think about your own business model, you need to think about the value you're going to offer these people and what these people actually need. Mm-hmm. So one way to do it is possibly reverse engineer. Think about the kind of people who have money today who are thinking of grant making, and how can you get them excited about meeting a variety of people in the nonprofit community. So by bringing those funders and people who have access to capital, you're going to be drawing bees to honey in terms of bringing people to your networking organization. So by thinking about why these people want to take time out of their day to actually meet each other, you know, what's the value for them? Maybe that professional development comes from the side, but what motivates them to come at the beginning is, you know, the idea that they're going to be meeting people that can help them get funding down the road. So perhaps that's one way to think about how you can get these people to come to your organization. And, you know, I would think that if budgets are tight, you need to give them something that really adds a lot of value to their company.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
And with the internet and information technology, there's
got to
be ways to do that. Any thoughts?
So to make sure I'm processing the question properly, so it's a group of people that help each other and kind of refer business to each other?
No, just people that I've met. You know, I'm a financial advisor. I know attorneys, you know, coaches, where a lot of the business we do is one-on-one. So ideas to bring in other revenue streams to kind of supplement that.
Yeah, I mean, you guys definitely all have such a very specific skill set. And that I would think, you know, it would again be a content business of some kind, right? So taking some of your unique knowledge and making like a little white paper, or making, you know, a very small detailed niche book that people can download, and, you know, offering it through like cross-marketing between the variety of professionals that you deal with. So the lawyer helps the accountant helps the trust attorney, and going back and forth. So one idea could be the content marketing, like finding a little. Another could be the networking, because if you're referring business back to each other, if there's ways to get informal referral fees, if there's ways to grow that network, so you can, you know, think about who else might be good customers for the people that you deal with every day. And by bringing those customers to other people, then you're adding value, and there's definitely a way to make money from that, like through affiliates or referral fees. This would be my initial ideas. Yes, over there.
My other question is, so with massage, I want it to be more of not a luxury, but a necessity. And so that means I have to discount my prices for a lot of people. But how do I discount prices, but yet make money? So, I mean, I do discount my prices normally just because I'm kind of a pushover, and I want everyone to come in.
Right.
But yet then how do I bring the clients that can pay compared to the clients that can't pay but are in a lot of pain and have a lot of injury? And, I don't know if the problem is that I want to help everyone, and maybe I can't help everybody, but how do I make money at all if I just keep discounting and discounting and discounting.
So there's two thoughts when it comes to lowering your price point. I think the whole idea is by lowering your price, are you bringing more people into your business? And are those people going to stick around and pay more down the road? Because if you're discounting your product and those customers are only going to come back to you for that discounted service, you're sort of shooting yourself in the foot. Mm-hmm. There's two things to think about. Could you offer a trial where, you know, someone gets maybe like a punch card and they get three cheaper massages with the idea that once they see how fabulous your massages are, they're going to come back over and over again anyway. The other thing you could think about is if people just don't have the same kind of money to spend on a service like a massage, could you offer shorter services? So could you offer, instead of an hour-long massage, maybe a half-an-hour massage or a 40-minute massage, and maybe...
Or just work on, like, the left side of their body? And then they just walk in circles?
Right. Just one shoulder today, sir. So by tailoring your services, because, you know, the real reality is that, you know, in this economy, people are having to make choices in terms of where they spend their money. And if you're not offering food and shelter, you're pretty much affected by that. Mm-hmm. So by keeping that customer coming back to you, can you just offer a more tailored service that looks cheaper to the customer, but isn't necessarily less profitable for you? So like a half hour massage that costs 40, maybe just 40% less. You're still making a little bit more, but like you can use your time as a massage therapist to see that many more clients.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions here today? Yeah.
Hi, my name's Angela. I'm currently in the process of starting, and it's been this year-long process, which I guess I have a two-tiered question. One is, how do you suggest we gain traction on projects that we've kind of had in the loo for a year, year and a half, and every now and then life is going great, something happens, and you're like, you know, where's that project on the side? I'm going to pick it back up, touch it, and then it kind of loses traction and then picks back up again. So can you say anything as to where it's giving advice for having a stick with something, having a plan, executing it, then building on the plan and executing it and following through even though we want to just stop?
Is this a business that you're trying to start?
A business that you're trying to start.
Yeah. So I think what you're describing is something that like most of us do all the time, every day. And it's, I think one big piece of advice that I have to give you is understanding that the people who do find success in entrepreneurship, it's not because they're smarter than you, that they went to better schools, that they just have this like magical power. The people who find exceptional success are the ones who stick with it when it gets rough and then just keep coming back. And in order to do that, you have to have a level of mental toughness. So it's that discipline that you can give yourself that's going to allow you to stay on track with your passions and your projects and allow you to take something and actually make it a reality. Some of the things you can do, and again, I'm going to get a little wonky on you, it's to activate that side of the brain that focuses on reward. And so one of the things that immediately does that is by focusing things that you're passionate about. Just anything that you're passionate about automatically causes that like chemical reaction in your brain, and you're much more likely to stick to it. Another thing you can do is set very small, achievable goals. Mm-hmm. So instead of having this, you know, I'm going to do $2 million by the end of the year. What? 3 months till the end of the year? So instead of setting these like goals you can't achieve, start very, very small, because and with that goal setting, create a vision in your mind. The vision is basically a destination for your car, like where the car is going to go. But the motor for that car are those tiny little successes. So create goals that are very, very short term, no more than 3 months in length. Mm-hmm. And make sure that those goals are few, just maybe one or two goals, and make them very achievable and make sure that they actually pick up from your innate talents. And so when you start setting these very short-term goals, you set yourself up to have little successes that cause that chemical release. And before you know it, you can't even help yourself. You're already starting to hit those goals.
And for those three goals, I know I have this problem. I don't know if you guys do too, but you have three things and you kind of hop around from thing A, B, and C. And would you suggest hopping around from A, B, and C, or attacking A, whether it be building a platform, a website, B, building your social media platform, and C, strategy? Or would you say we can't do, not strategy, that's bad, the whole thing is strategy, but C for something else that we have to do in this three goals for the next 3 months?
I would say maybe start with one goal and make that goal exceptionally specific. Something that like is very tangible and something that you can say at the end of 3 months, I actually did that. So like creating a social media strategy, you know, you might create the strategy, but then what? I don't know what you do with that. But if you say, I'm going to actually get 300 Twitter followers, or I'm going to get, you know, 500 likes on Facebook. That's what I'm talking about. Something very specific and tangible. Something that relies on skills you have, things you can actually do. Because when you set yourself up for those tiny successes, chemically you set yourself on a track to do more and more and more. And it's, again, you can't fight the physiology. Say you set three goals and you get two of them and you don't get one. It is human nature to focus on the one that you didn't get. You're not going to be talking about the two that you got. And so when you miss goals, you actually feel a drain of that same chemical and it demotivates you. Yeah. So you're shooting yourself in the foot. Set very basic, achievable goals, and in a very small period of time, do one, and then move on to the next one.
Okay, great. And last question. Yeah. So I run I've been starting, but then I traveled and left and started other projects, but it's in me to just keep doing it. It's when you leave a project, and in the back of your mind, you know, I really should do this, and you're not going to sleep well at night until you do it and see if it works. And so my project or end product is a hair care management consultation firm for multiracial families and adoptive kids for a tightly coiled frizzy hair, and just helping parents who didn't think they were going to be in a lifestyle of that, just kind of bracing them. There's a heavy saturation of information on the market, but I kind of want to just go in there. A lot of people don't have time. They spend lots of money on products, and in the end, it's just really an image building for their children that needs to be done that a lot of parents don't realize that they have the responsibility to do. So I'm at a crossroads where it's, do I build a platform of engagement via a blog or a website? Do I just go straight and build a product? Do I go hands in and actually show people by giving individual consultation, procedures and processes? And I'm just a big cloud of ideas, and I'm not sure exactly how to narrow it down into tangible achievements because it's so enormous in my head.
Yeah, I think that this might be one of the reasons why like you've been picking this up and putting it down for the last year and a half. What my suggestion to you would be to go to the tree and pick the lowest hanging fruit of all of the different ideas that you have. You're still at the phase where you've got a notion, but you don't actually have any kind of proof of concept yet. So what I would do is think a little bit about what your talents are, what you can offer people, and what can you start doing in market very, very quickly. And, you know, focus on that. And in the process of getting out there and just doing like something very, very small in offering your service, maybe it's like an event that you hold mm-hmm. where you offer people advice. Maybe it's a website that you set up on WordPress for free, and then you start to see the kind of feedback you get. It doesn't really matter where you start. You just need to start, and you need to get out there and stop massaging this in a bubble and letting the customer tell you what they actually need. I think getting out there, you're going to start to see that people would rather have this information online versus in a one-on-one format. One thing I want to tell you is we keep talking about Steve Jobs, right? Steve Jobs is like that entrepreneur who, you know, made gold. I don't think a lot of people actually know how he got started. When he was a student in high school, he met Steve Wozniak, and they read about this guy in the 70s that was hacking into the phone system, Ma Bell. And so they started creating these little blue boxes that allow people to make free long-distance calls. And, you know, that was their first business. And they got busted by the police. All those little devices were taken away, but it was an amazing learning opportunity for both of the Steves. In the process, Steve Jobs discovered that he actually had amazing marketing chops, and Steve Wozniak discovered that he knew how to build technology. And you just have to get out there and do it. You need to go freak phones and make that little box that you have no idea where that's going to take you, but you need to get out there and do something small because the evolution of business will find you on its own.
Thanks. Yeah. That was great.
Thanks. Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.